Adversaries are relentless, and they're only getting smarter, faster, and more sophisticated. Knowing their game is the only way to beat them. That's why we're here. Learn what it takes to protect against even the most sophisticated attacks. Welcome to the Adversary Universe podcast.
Adam, welcome to another episode of the Adversary Universe podcast. I'm here with the head of our counter-adversary operations group, Mr. Adam Myers. How are you?
Hi, how are you doing?
I am doing fantastic. What a cheery response from you.
You know what? I'm just happy to be here.
Are you really?
I am. I'm always happy to be here.
I'm always happy to be here.
It's such a nice break from the drudgery of tracking adversaries and stopping breaches to have a nice discussion with Christian Rodriguez.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, likewise, we're always active. There's no shortage of work. And, you know, I think that the bad guys are fast. We're always faster. We're always tracking what they're doing. And it is a passion project, you know, this podcast. And so we appreciate our listeners and supporters giving us great feedback on the content. We appreciate all of our guest speakers. And today we have a fascinating guest speaker joining us.
Special guest speaker. Who is an accomplished chef.
Is he? Really?
He was telling us about his, beforehand, we were hearing about the special egg recipe.
You know, I thought it was a bit of a flex, but I didn't want to point it out. So for those of you new to the podcast, I'm your co-host, Christian Rodriguez, Field CTO of the Americas. And today's guest is, again, a fascinating speaker. He's essentially our chief security officer, as one of the company's longest tenured executive leaders here. Joining us after retiring from the FBI Senior Executive Service, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Sean Henry. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing great. That's quite the buildup, but thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with two of my favorite people in the fight against our adversaries. Thanks, Christian and Adam, both.
Thank you so much for joining the podcast, Sean. You know, I'd love for you to spend some time, especially for our listeners not familiar with your role, giving us a little background on, you know, how you got here with the company, maybe explaining also your time at the FBI and what you did and some of the divisions that you were a part of.
Yep. Well, thanks again for having me here. You know, I spent 24 years in the FBI. I started in 1989. It was a dream of mine to be in law enforcement. My father was a New York City detective. I was always interested in law enforcement. I had a family friend who graduated from the academy when I was a senior in high school. And from that moment forward, I really, everything that I did was me trying to get into the Bureau. I just had this fascination with protecting good people from bad things. And I had a long career there, 24 years. I got involved in cyber in the FBI in 1999, right before Y2K. And I was the chief of the computer intrusion unit at a place called the National Infrastructure Protection Center, which was a aggregate of all the different federal agencies, some international partners, as well as private sector folks. This is in 99, 2000, and I had multiple positions over the course of the next 10 years. I retired as executive assistant director of the Bureau, responsible for all the FBI's criminal investigations, cyber investigations, international operations, and critical incident response. And then a friend introduced me to George Kurtz, said that she had a friend that was looking to start this company and interested in somebody with my background to run the professional services organization. And I met George for dinner, and long story short, came over to CrowdStrike. I was employee number 19. Adam was already here. So I joined, I retired from the Bureau 2012, started the next day after I retired, literally the next day, with CrowdStrike, came in as the president of CrowdStrike Services and the chief security officer of the company. So overseeing all of our services. Interestingly enough, we had no employees in services. And when we got our first lead that came in, it was for a company that had some highly technical and sophisticated technology that was breached by China. And through a contact I had, they contacted me and asked if we could investigate. We had just brought two guys on board, and it really was kind of shoestring at the time, trying to do this investigation, and we were working over the internet together. We ultimately helped that company, and they became a customer, and you know, the rest is kind of history. What was fascinating for me, Christian, was I had just left the Bureau, and I'd been in charge of major investigations with hundreds of agents and analysts. And here I come to CrowdStrike. You know, I was the 19th employee. I had these two guys on my team, and I had to ask a couple of folks from the Intel side, Adam's team, to help out. And we were sitting, I remember sitting on my laptop in my backyard, and we were communicating back and forth. I guess it wasn't Slack or Teams. I don't even remember what the application was, but we were communicating and working the case collaboratively online. And that was completely brand new to me, because in the Bureau, we never did that. I mean, we were all together in a room.
Sure.
And the opportunity to investigate virtually was kind of eye-opening for me. And it's, you know, looking back now, it seems pretty rudimentary to what we're currently doing. But at the time, it was really
almost like a novel experience, essentially, yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's interesting, though, because at the time, it was also kind of novel, because most of the IR teams would fly in. And so, like, this is when, you know, day one, I think that Sean and team started kind of having to innovate, because there was no fly in, right? There was really, like, we had to get started that day.
Yep. It was quite interesting. It turned out actually to be a pretty big case. At this time, you know, 2012, the government was not publicly talking about nation state adversaries.
Oh, interesting.
They were not talking about Russia or China or Iran. I knew, because I had just come from the government, I knew that nation states were engaged in this type of activity, but nobody in the government would talk publicly about it. It was interesting, because once I came to the private sector, to CrowdStrike, and I started to pick up intelligence related to nation states and talking to Adam about how he was collecting and kind of the evolution of Adam's intelligence program, I now had intelligence that was collected by the private sector, not collected by the government, where sources and methods are protected. Sure. And it's all top secret, sensitive, compartmented information. You can't talk about it. I actually had very similar information that I had on the government side that was collected in an unclassified environment. And I actually could start talking about it publicly. And I think it wasn't just me and Adam, there were others in other companies, but that was really the turning point, I think, when we had people who came out of the government were collecting in an unclassified environment, sensitive information, but unclassified in terms of collection, and started to talk about and cast a picture of who these people were. And I think that was really the brilliance behind what Adam did, which was give these foreign intelligence services a persona.
A persona, yeah.
And it really changed the dynamic and got people to focus on, hey, this isn't computers attacking computers. These are people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I always say this, it was one of the major, my turning point for career-wise, when I interviewed with CrowdStrike and I saw an intelligence report, I was just fascinated. You know, that overlay of a persona on these adversaries, for me, it was an eye-opening experience to understanding that there is a human behind the keyboard. And, you know, I was all in since then. So
I was just so glad. When I was in the government, I wanted to talk about this, but I understand sources and methods and protecting how data is collected, that you can't do it. I get that. Although I think that sometimes the government holds that a little too close, and I think they could have allowed for more intelligence to get out there. And I really think that Adam, what he did was the impetus for that. It was really the model for how to do it.
Yeah, I think that was back when it was an advanced persistent threat. End of message.
Yeah, that's a good point. So now, in the vein of nation state activity being a lot more public, there's a lot more acknowledgement of what nation state intelligence collections look like. We've seen the likes of China in the spotlight when it came to, for example, the Microsoft hack, you know, last year. Russia naturally involved in a variety of different campaigns. Microsoft again.
Wait, which Microsoft hack?
The Cozy Bear. Well, ooh, again,
because there was also the Chinese getting access to the sensitive emails of like the Department of Commerce.
That is very, very true. And so, but with that said, you know, there is no slowing down of nation state activity. And Adam, we just released our global threat report recently, and there's some interesting statistics that we covered in a previous episode, but this is also an interesting year in the grand scheme of nation state attacks impacting a lot of major electoral changes, right? Or major geopolitical events that are happening. How many countries are going through some type of major change this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's 42% of the Earth's population, I think, is going to be electing new leadership.
Oh, wow.
55 countries. You know, it's hard to say for certain because there's some things that haven't been officially announced or planned yet. But, you know, it looks like about 55.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, Sean and I have been kind of talking a lot about this on air and to the media because this is a huge concern.
Sure.
And, you know, Sean knows intimately what went down back in 2016. That was, I think, a defining event when we found Fancy Bear at the Democratic National Convention or Democratic Maybe. National Committee.
Committee. Yeah.
Yeah. Before the convention. And, you know, that was, I think, I don't know, Sean, we could get into this a little bit, but I remember we put that blog post out about what happened and what we found in the investigation. And I think we were all kind of like, yeah, we did good. We put a blog post out, we exposed this and it's intel collection. And within about 24 hours, Guccifer 2.0 shows up and starts, you know, starts basically trolling us. And that was not what I think any of us had expected. I think that was a new day when that happened because, you know, we'd all seen intel collection espionage before, which you would expect to see in an election cycle. But to have disinformation and influence operations start to pop up, that I think blew a lot of minds.
Yeah,
when
I was in the Bureau in 2008, I was the assistant director of the cyber division in the FBI. And at the time, and this is public now, but it had been classified, but this is public. The Chinese accessed both the Obama campaign and the McCain campaign and were collecting intelligence off of both of those campaigns. And it was, as Adam described, it was clear espionage. You know, they're looking to see who the next president of the United States, what their political policies are, what are their economic policies, what is their stand on national defense, you know, who are they aligned with, who are they supportive of, that is espionage. And by the way, espionage is accepted by countries against other countries. Countries spy on other countries. We actually notified both the McCain campaign and I personally notified the Obama campaign about it. Fast forward to 2016, and when we saw what we saw in the DNC, and Adam is absolutely right. I believed, and shame on me for underestimating the Russians, I believed that it was an intelligence campaign. And in conversations with the DNC, we went public with it because we wanted the public to understand what was going on. And I remember vividly going on television the day this was released and talking about it. And I was talking about the Russians targeting the intelligence of the different candidates and specifically what their policies were. And we saw them touch those files. And to me, that was pure espionage. And that was normal. And talking to the public about it was normal. There's a foreign government that's trying to collect intelligence against the, you know, US campaign. And then when Guccifer 2 and this whole thing became operationalized, where there was this very public use of a persona to try and call out CrowdStrike and to step away from Russian intelligence services and to say specifically, this is a Romanian hacker, it's not the Russian government, and to put question into what had been released. And then, you know, the ensuing, you know, months down the road where there were emails that were released and there was misinformation that was injected into the emails. And it was very obvious pretty quickly that this was much more than just a pure espionage campaign, which is what I expected from a foreign intelligence service. This was a very, very different playbook.
Now, you and I haven't really talked about this in a long time, I don't think. But this is a good place for us to kind of maybe explain some of the thinking and stuff. But do you think that the blog post forced the Russians' hands and that they were not ready to launch that campaign and that operation when they did? Do you think it was planned for later?
I don't think it ever would have been public. I think emails would have been leaked and I think there would have been misinformation put out, but I don't think there would have been a persona. I think Guccifer was a kind of spontaneous reaction to what happened.
Almost like a deceptive scapegoat of some sort.
I think that they were scrambling. It was reactive. It wasn't proactive. I think that the emails would have come out in drips and drabs. It's similar to some of the things we're seeing now. I think there would have been a lot of use of, you know, continued use of social media, but I don't think it would have been as forward. But the fact that we pulled the covers back and said, you know, this is a Russian intelligence operation targeting the U.S. election, by the way. And it's, I think it's really important. At no point were we ever suggesting it was political. We were saying they were targeting the U.S. election, and there was no inclination towards a particular candidate. There was no, from our perspective, there was nothing partisan. It was what I'd seen in 2008 by China, and now here I see the what I think is the same from Russia, and that's normal. Yeah. And by, you know, going back, Christian, to what we said a little earlier, in 2008, it was completely classified and nobody talked about it because it was the government who uncovered it. In 2016, by the way, the FBI uncovered it first. You know, the FBI notified the DNC 9 months before CrowdStrike ever got involved. So the government knew about it. But once CrowdStrike knew about it, because we collected that intelligence in an unclassified environment, we could talk about it. And for me, I thought it was important for the public to understand what was happening. Sure. And, you know, I think the DNC felt the same way. And, you know, it became operationalized very, very quickly. And I think demonstrates the real risk to our election and where we are today in 2024, not just in the United States, but globally that there are nations who want to disrupt democracy. They're not just targeting the United States. They are targeting democracy globally.
And I think that's why it's, you know, in the Global Threat Report, we call out the scope of how much of the world is running these elections. And we've seen these, you know, influence and, you know, we'll come back, I think, in a second and talk about some of the new technology, the generative AI and the deepfake technology that's become readily available. But the capability to influence these elections is not just Russia. It's more widespread. We've seen this in Taiwan back in January. We're seeing this, you know, across all of the elections that are occurring, that there is the use of deepfake disinformation, misinformation. And I think that that is the reality of the modern election process.
No, so that's a very important keyword. So Sean, you mentioned it, Adam, you just mentioned it, the word misinformation, right? So we've seen these adversaries or these nation states implement these campaigns that are focused on deception and disruption. But give us an example of what a misinformation campaign looks like, or maybe something that you've observed while you were in the Bureau, Sean.
I won't talk specifics, but at a high level though, I mean, it's taking, pieces of information, maybe taking something completely out of context and using the echo chamber known as social media. And I think this is something we should talk about here, because I think social media has been the biggest change in the last 10 years in the amplification of messages. And so it's just taking a piece and amplifying it through this echo chamber to individuals, to the public. We've seen actors that have taken a very specific, I'll say flammable issue, Second Amendment issue, abortion issue, you know, Black Lives Matter
social
issue, and amplifying it on both sides. So amplifying one portion to a particular group of the population and amplifying the other side of that position to another part of the populace. And it's done specifically to create a divide. Mm. It's to create social unrest. It's to create division. You know, a country divided is a heck of a lot weaker than a country that's united. And I think that that is part of the destruction of democracy, is to cause people, rather than having civil discourse, to amplify the message where people get angry and people get frustrated and people get violent. And I really believe that that is the playbook. And I think that we've seen it. I think that we've seen it in a number of different areas. And, you know, not just the U.S. government, but allied governments have called this out. You know, the bots that have been used through social media to amplify over and over and magnify these messages has created the great divide. And I think that that is the precipice we sit on. And that is the greatest danger that we face right now.
From the from a Russia perspective, I think it's interesting. This, you know, they've got a history of this going back to, you know, really the start of the Soviet Union, that there was a lot of attempts to break up NATO, to disrupt the capabilities to create the European Union, to try to drive a wedge in the United States on the topics that Sean mentioned. And it's not lost, I think, on a lot of us that Guccifer 2.0 documents that were leaked, you know, a day after that blog post came out, the author in some of those documents had been changed to Felix Dzerzhinsky, who was I think I pronounced that right, Dzerzhinsky, he was the original head of Soviet intelligence. And, you know, they were, I think, sending a not so subtle message there.
Interesting. Okay, so misinformation is this overarching category tied to this campaign, again, to deceive, as you mentioned, Sean, and disrupt and create divide within a country or a nation. How do you see AI now being a part of these campaigns, right? I'm sure it lends itself to enhancing these misinformation campaigns with more than just, you know, separating opinions. But, you know, what type of influence do we see Gen AI and all of the new capabilities that AI has brought to folks' fingertips?
And we should note that we started this off with a deep fake demo before we start hit the record button, where I showed up as somebody else.
We won't say
actually
who.
That's actually a good way to start. When we started this podcast, you're right. Adam showed up in another persona, looking like somebody else, talking with Adam's voice, but clearly somebody else's face, which was his use of deep fake. I think we've just scratched the surface with AI from a deep fake perspective. Gen AI is a little different, but when we talk about the use of new personas and getting to a place where people cannot believe what they see or what they hear because it's manufactured by somebody with a clear objective to deceive. And we've seen good examples of it. We've seen examples that upon close scrutiny probably wouldn't hold up. But when somebody sees just a snippet, it's quick, or they hear it very quickly. They don't have the opportunity to go back and revisit it and analyze it. It's real. And then it gets magnified through social media again and again. And again, when people are sharing sound bites and video, people aren't paying that close attention. I think that the average person is just not scrutinizing the source of data,
sure,
and the source of information. And that, to me, is the biggest vulnerability from an AI or deep fake perspective as it relates to the election process.
No,
and it's almost as if they don't want to, right? Like you got this confirmation bias where if I see something on social media and it portrays one of the candidates in a negative light, and I already have this negative perception of that person, and I'm going to accept that, and I'm not going to look any deeper because it's already confirming what I think And so it's not, I'm not incentivized to say, wait a minute, I don't think he would do that, or I don't think sure. that she would actually be like that. And this is where, you know, by the when this happens late in the election cycle and nobody is verifying it that closely, you know, it becomes kind of the meme or the you know, the thought virus that's propagating.
Sure. Kind of false reality.
And I think, you know, we think about this on the national election level, but I'm more concerned about it at the local election level. I think mm-hmm. as we've seen how local politics, particularly, you know, during the pandemic became very important. I think as we look at Chinese influence in, you know, acquiring land here in the United States and in places like Texas near military bases, as we look at how they care about particular local agendas that can drive the broader global Chinese initiatives through things like Belt and Road Initiative or the 14th Five-Year Plan, that those local elections become really important, and we'll start to see more of what we experienced in 2016 occurring at the state and local level in the future.
Yeah, in the future. No, I'm also curious about the youth, right? So I have, you know, two daughters. One,
the youths.
You know, you think about, you know, my kids. I have two daughters. One is 18. One is 21. They've grown up in this very heavy social media world. They are into doom scrolling. The content that they're served is very quick and short, and they're off to the next video. And so, I'm very curious about your opinion on how the younger generation is impacted by these misinformation campaigns, because holding their attention is fairly difficult. And sometimes they see something. I can't tell you the amount of times my daughters approach me to say, "Hey, Dad, did you know X?" And I would have to correct her and say, "No, that's actually not true. And that video is fake." Or
he said, "No, it's actually called Twitter."
Exactly. Back in my days, it was a tweet. And so, you know, I'm very curious on the influence that these misinformation campaigns have on a generation that isn't used to validating the content that they run across, right?
I think that you're absolutely right. You know, I've watched people scroll TikTok and other social media, and you know, they're catching the news, and I'm using air quotes here. They're catching the news sure. in 10, 15 second increments, and certainly that's not enough to be judicious and thoughtful in analyzing what's happening. Whenever I think about risk, what is the risk, right? The risk I see is the threat to democracy. What's the threat? Threat actors, Russia, China, Iran, others that want to discredit, which, because the risk is high and I know who the threat actors are, I am very thoughtful in, you know, where's this source of information coming from? Is it a valid news source? Has it been multi-sourced rather than just single-sourced? But that is not happening with the youth. And we need to change it culturally. People need to understand that the risk is there, that the threat is there, and have this very clear objective. And they are taking great extreme measures to force their objectives and to accomplish their goals. And people need to change how they consume, or they need to learn that when they consume, they have to be thoughtful. I think it's no different than, you know, all the things that we've been taught growing up. You know, look both ways before you cross the street.
Sure.
Buckle your seatbelt when you get in the car. I mean, things that become just normal, they happen automatically, muscle memory. It needs to be the same with social media and how we consume news. Validate your sources. Check what you're looking at. Make sure that who's telling you this, what is their objective? And that's a lot easier said than done. I think sometimes people are not as intellectually curious as they need to be. Maybe they're lazy. It takes a little bit of effort, takes some work to do this. But I think the stakes are so high, we have to do it. I also would add, Christian, that there's probably more the government can do in terms of regulation. And I think that some of the outlets that are hosting this misinformation, that are complicit, in my opinion, in fomenting and distributing misinformation, that there needs to be some level of accountability. And I think that there needs to be further scrutiny in how that's done, to hold enterprises accountable for some of the information that they're putting out. And that's, I know that that is a complex process. There's First Amendment issues and privacy issues, et cetera. But I think that, again, the stakes are so high that we need to be thoughtful in how we evaluate and assess and ultimately regulate what's happening. And that's a tough thing to do.
Yeah, it is tough. Well, actually, that's a really good segue, though, with respect to addressing misinformation for the younger generation. But how do we start defending against the threats against our electoral or the elections that are coming up for both the U.S. and even on a global scale? Like, what would you recommend?
Well, I think it's much of the same. I think in a world, or I'll focus on the U.S. here, in a country where there is a great divide, there are extremists on both sides of the aisle that are very vocal in their messaging. I think that there needs to be some moderation. I think people have to understand the real risk. And when there are people who are very, very active and popular, and they have a big voice and a big platform, and they are making statements that are factually incorrect, very large statements that are factually incorrect, that's dangerous. I think it comes down to education and people understanding what these risks are. There's no magic bullet here. I think that the government is going to get involved in moderation. I won't even say regulation. That's a word that causes people some angst.
Sure.
But moderation. Let's be more thoughtful in how we're doing this. And I think the metaphor about yelling fire in a crowded theater is a great metaphor, because I am a believer in free speech for sure. But I can't get up publicly and defame somebody with factually inaccurate information. I can't do it. It's illegal. It's not right. It's against the law. I can't get up in a crowded theater and scream fire, because it poses a safety hazard. It poses a threat to human life by doing that. And I think that what we're facing right now is a threat to democracy and the country as we know it. And I think that it's important for there to be some moderation in how that happens, particularly as it relates to social media.
What do you think about in terms of Section 230? For anybody that's not familiar with that, it's part of the Telecommunications Act, I believe, where it basically grants immunity for online computer services with respect to third-party content, meaning that if you're hosting like social media, that it sets effectively that if you let something or don't moderate something, that you're not at fault, I guess.
I've used a metaphor. I've talked about 230 before, and I've used a metaphor. You know, if I own a warehouse and I lease it to somebody, and then they start running a drug operation out of the warehouse, you know, do I have some obligation as the warehouse owner to have some understanding as to what's happening in my property that I own, that I pay taxes on? You know, do I have some obligation there? And I think that historically people have been held accountable for what's happened in their property, even though they didn't cause the actions. I think that it's something that needs to be discussed in a broad way, again, because of the risk. You know, when you think about security always is based on risk. The level of security is based on risk. You know, I can walk into a park, you know, without going through a magnetometer, or I could walk into the grocery store without going through a magnetometer, but I can't get on an airplane without going to a magnetometer. And the risk is assessed as being much higher. Getting on an airplane. I think when we're talking about some of the things we're talking about here and how misinformation is being used to undermine democracy and to foment this sense of disruption and discourse, I think that the risk is so high that we have to look at this with a little more scrutiny and be, again, moderated differently. It's the same reason you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, because somebody might die and you can't do it. First Amendment is great. Can't do it. I could say it in my house. I could say it at a party with a couple friends, But if I
you
say,
can say it, if there is a fire.
Yeah. It's just the type of thing, Adam. I think that the stakes are so high that there needs to be the bar needs to be higher. The bar needs to be higher. When people scream First Amendment, I'm a big supporter of First Amendment. But there are guidelines on the First Amendment. I can't make up stories and publicly go out and say somebody is a rapist or, you know, somebody is a murderer or they committed fraud unless there are facts that say that that actually happened. I can't do it. So First Amendment is not a universal right to say whatever you want, whenever you want. That's not a right. There are some guidelines. We live in a society where there are rules and, you know, other people have rights as well. I have the right not to be defamed. And if I am defamed, then, you know, somebody should be held accountable. And I agree with all that. So, you know, when it comes to certain platforms and media outlets being held completely immune from that, I think that that's probably not the case. Again, lots of variables, and you know, it's got to be fact specific or case specific. There's no one size fits all, but I think that there needs to be a lot more moderation in the way these platforms operate.
No, I think this is really eye opening because most folks will hear something about election security and they'll instantly associate that concept with, you know, unplugging the voting machines at night, right? Or ensuring that the voting machines are protected, not really thinking about more of the social aspect of misinformation campaigns impacting the potential results some major election change or political change.
I think that's the number one takeaway, though, is that, you know, when we were talking about this back in 2016 and 2020, and I was talking, I'm sure, Sean, you got this question a lot too from journalists asking, well, what can we do to protect the election? Like, how are they going to hack into the voting machines? And I kept saying, they're not going to. They don't need to. They just have to create the appearance of an issue. They just have to inject the doubt, that seed of doubt into people's minds, and the rest of it will take care of itself. They don't need to actually hack a physical device.
That's such a great point, Adam. You know, I talked earlier about social issues that are incendiary, right? Second Amendment, abortion. But, you know, fake elections is one of those issues. And if the public really understood that there are foreign intelligence services, foreign governments that are putting this information out and magnifying it specifically to create that doubt in our election system. When we doubt what we see and what we hear, when we put into question the validity of an election, and that is being pushed by foreign governments who have the intent to disrupt our democracy. And to me, it's just so clear because I've seen it for so many years. And it's shocking to me that people don't understand that. It's not about hacking into a system and changing the votes. It's about creating this question among 350 million Americans that our system is susceptible and our system is rigged. And that's just not the case.
Yeah, there's I think there's a perception issue, and that is what the threat actors, the adversaries are taking advantage of. You know, one thing we've talked about Russia, we've talked about China, but, you know, back in 2020, there was a fake video that came out that purported to show the Proud Boys were creating fake election ballots. And that was almost immediately attributed to Iran.
That was very quickly identified. And I think that was put out by the government. And I think that the turnaround on that was very, very quick. I don't have any inside information about that, but I suspect that that was identified through covert collection of the government, some sensitive collection that was classified. I suspect that. And that in order for them to put that out, it would have had to have been very quickly declassified. And I think that is a good example where the government, and there are other good examples, where the government has very quickly taken classified data, scrubbed it, and put it into an unclassified channel, at least some of the high points, because it's important for the public to understand that. Do you believe that too, Adam?
That the government had collection or
Well, both that the government had collection and that the government, that the, it was a quick turn to get it out. And it was done because the stakes were so high that it was a quick turn. Like, we got to declassify this quickly and get it out. That's what I believe.
Yeah, it was within a day, I think, that the USG had come out with anything specific to that. But I think that there was actually some infrastructure they left in. They made some mistakes in the video, if I remember correctly. And they had shown the, I think there was like an IP address or something that might have tied back to Iran.
Yeah, but some of that, you know, as you know, Adam, attribution is hard. And there are so many variables. And I think with the focus on companies like CrowdStrike and others to do attribution, there's probably a lot more cover that's used by intelligence services. I think they're probably a lot more circumspect in what they're doing, and that their security protocols have increased over the last 5 or 10 years because they recognize that there's attribution being done. And I think if you want to get pure attribution, it's eyes on as it actually happens. It's actually seeing, you know, the keyboard entries being done, and that's done through very, very sensitive collection. And I think that in some of the cases where I've seen very clear attribution, and by the way, it happened in the DNC. If you read the indictment, they had keystrokes. They literally had keystrokes that this person by name entered this command specifically. That they had collection. They either had collection or they had a human being who told them, because you could not get that level of specificity without direct collection. So, well, I mean, that's where you get true attribution.
I knew it was Fancy Bear the second I saw X Agent.
Yeah, I know you did. I know you did. I believe you and I have confidence in you, but trust but verify.
Yeah, exactly.
The indictment gave me that extra level of confidence that, the government was collecting on this and they saw it because they were physically there. You know, virtually they were there.
Oh, wow. Well, it's fascinating. But Sean, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us and helping our listeners at least cut through the fog of misinformation that, you know, we're probably going to see a lot more of as we get into this year's elections. And we're going to see this again across a variety of other countries. But I think this is really great perspective, again, on understanding, or at least going through the concept of validating and being a little more informed with respect to understanding where the truth is, or, you know, how to validate that truth, or at least questioning some of the integrity of the content that's showing up on your social media feeds.
I think it's the responsibility of every consumer to understand where data is coming from, because the stakes are too high, the risks are too high, and we need to be more thoughtful and judicious and analytical. It's unfortunate that we're in that environment. We can't just accept what we see and hear. But there are groups that want to disrupt us and hurt us. And the potential for us to have our lives as we know it changed is there. So I appreciate you hosting this venue, giving me the opportunity to chat. It's something I'm very passionate about. And I really appreciate what both of you are doing to fight the fight and to help keep Americans safe. So thanks.
Thank you.
Well, we got to definitely get Sean back. This was fun.
Yeah.
And it's always a pleasure to chat with Sean. I usually get to see him every now and again at corporate events. So it's good to have him on the show, and look forward to having him back.
You got it. Yeah. Thank you, Sean, so much.
All right, guys. Bye-bye right now.
This is the Adversary Universe podcast, and we will catch you on the next episode.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you're hearing, subscribe to our podcast and head over to crowdstrike.com/adversaries to learn more about the many bad guys we track. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Adversary Universe podcast.
This is the Adversary Universe podcast.